Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Dr. Sophia Chang, Director of the California Healthcare Foundation's Better Chronic Disease Care Program. Find the Commonwealth Club on the Internet at commonwealthclub.org and the Foundation at chcf.org. This program is underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. And now, it is a privilege and pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker this evening, Dr. Francis S. Collins, the Director of the National Institutes of Health. The NIH is the federal agency that is the nation's largest supporter of biomedical research, spanning the spectrum from basic to clinical research. Dr. Collins is a physician geneticist noted for his landmark discoveries of disease genes, such as cystic fibrosis and Huntington's disease, and his leadership of the International Human Genome Project, which completely sequenced or mapped the human DNA instruction book in April 2003. He served as director of the National Human Genome Research Institute at the NIH from 1993 to 2008 and took the helm of the NIH in August of 2009. Before coming to the NIH, Dr. Collins was a Howard Hughes Medical Institute investigator at the University of Michigan. He is an elected member of the Institute of Medicine and the National Academy of Sciences. He was awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2007 and the National Medal of Science in 2009. He earned his B.S. in chemistry from the University of Virginia. He went on to attain his Ph.D. in physical chemistry at Yale University and then changed fields and enrolled at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where he earned his M.D. degree. Today, especially during these challenging economic times, one of Dr. Collins's top priorities is to accelerate the movement or translation of scientific advances from the research lab to the medical clinic. Despite dramatic progress we've made in identifying the molecular basis of many diseases, translation remains a slow, expensive, and failure-prone endeavor. For example, it currently takes about 13 years and more than $1 billion to develop a successful new drug. To help re-engineer this process, NIH recently announced plans to establish a new entity, the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences, or NCATS. Dr. Collins will describe how NCATS, along with other NIH research initiatives, will catalyze innovative methods and technologies to more rapidly become new treatments for a wide range of diseases. We have changed how we work, do business, and communicate drastically over the last decade, and now's the time to bring those advances to the translation of scientific knowledge to clinical practice. And what better moderator today on this topic than Dr. Larry Brilliant, the president and CEO of the Skoll Global Threats Fund. Dr. Brilliant is an epidemiologist, was former director of Google's philanthropic arm, Google.org, and was one of the original members of the successful World Health Organization smallpox eradication program in India and South Asia. Brilliant founded SIVA Foundation, which has worked in dozens of countries to prevent blindness and has given sight back to nearly 3 million people. He founded several technology startups, including The Well, a worldwide discussion forum. In 2008, Brilliant was named one of Time Magazine's 100 Most Influential People and received a Global Leadership Award by the United Nations. He received his MD from Wayne State and also has Michigan roots, receiving his MPH from the University of Michigan, where he was also Associate Professor of Epidemiology, Global Health Planning, and Economic Development. You'll hear from both of them this evening, but first, please welcome Dr. Francis Collins.
Thank you, Dr. Chang, for that very kind introduction. Good evening to all of you. It's a real pleasure to be here in the Bay Area, this being such a remarkable hub of innovation in many aspects of science, but particularly so in biomedical research. And I'm thrilled to have a chance to stand at a podium that so many other innovators have occupied to tell you something about what's happening in terms of activities at the National Institutes of Health, the world's largest supporter of biomedical research. So I'd like to tell you a story about both progress in the past, exciting science in the present, and the future promise of how this can revolutionize medicine and human health. And I guess also the challenges that we face in terms of resource constraints, which are a considerable issue at the present time, a challenge that I believe we can overcome with perseverance and partnerships and continued innovation. The reward for the success of this effort would be nothing short of a better, healthier future for ourselves, our country, and for the whole world. And at the center of this story is American biomedical research, and that is my topic. So the NIH is not exactly a household word. We wish we were. We wish when people said NIH, people wouldn't go, huh? We wish that somehow NIH was in the same category as NASA. Everybody knows what NASA does, but NIH, what's that? Well, NIH has been around for a long time, and it has a very impressive mission, which I actually will read to you. Science in pursuit of fundamental knowledge about the nature and behavior of living systems and the application of that knowledge to extend healthy life and reduce the burdens of illness and disability. What's not to love? So this is about figuring out how life works and how sometimes things go wrong and disease occurs. That's what we do. And I think when it comes to the basic understanding of living systems, one can point to achievements that NIH has supported and be fairly gratified by the outcomes. We have, as of today, funded 135 Nobel Prize winners, including the three that were announced this morning for their work on the immune system. And you can see that because our budget goes outside of the NIH, which is located in Bethesda, Maryland, to the great universities and institutes and small businesses around this country, that effectively whenever you hear of a major advance in biomedical research where somebody's made a breakthrough in understanding diabetes or cancer or heart disease or asthma, it's pretty likely that their work was supported by the National Institutes of Health. That's what we do. In fact, here in California, just this past year, $3.3 billion of taxpayers' dollars were awarded by NIH through our rigorous peer review process to 7,139 awardees. I would be remiss if I didn't point out to you that, in fact, California, of all the states in the union, has the largest amount of support from the National Institutes of Health. You even beat out Massachusetts, much to their dismay, I might say, and they're chasing hard to try to catch up. And they do great work as well. So the overall budget of the NIH is about $30 billion, a very significant investment. And again, this is taxpayer money. This is your money. This is awarded to us each year in a process that is, well, let's say it's political, that involves the Congress. It involves the administration. It involves, well, you know, a lot of sausage making. And ultimately, if we're lucky, we end up knowing what our budget's going to be. I can't help but point out, however, the fiscal year in the government starts on October 1st. Today is October 3rd. You would think we would have a budget, wouldn't you? Well, no. We have what's called a continuing resolution, which is a way of saying we're thinking about it. We're probably going to get there. Last year, they finally got there by April. This year, I think we'll get a budget a little sooner, maybe even in November, which would be remarkably wonderful because it's hard to plan science when you don't know actually what resources you have to spend. But it's our system. It is in the wisdom of the way in which our political process works. This is the way it happens. So that's what NIH is. That's our mission. Now, what have we done to actually deserve this kind of research support? And how could we justify the way in which this has played out? Well, let's look at what's happened, say, in the last 30 years. Life expectancy has grown from 71 years to 78 years. So we're still on a curve of increasing life expectancy in the U.S., about 1 year every 6 years. Specifically, cardiovascular disease, a major cause of premature death, has been greatly reduced in the last 40 years by 60% for heart attack deaths, by greater than 70% for stroke deaths. And we all sort of take that for granted, but that's a remarkable thing to be able to say. Why did that come about? You can draw a direct line from research that NIH supported in places like Framingham, Massachusetts, that taught us what really were the risk factors for heart disease and stroke and what to do about it. And all of the things that we are all now taking care of in terms of our own attention to preventing those diseases, such as making sure your cholesterol isn't out of whack and watching your blood pressure, are a direct consequence of those research studies. Look at HIV/AIDS. 20 years ago, a diagnosis of HIV positivity in a young person translated into a death sentence, that the expectation was that your life span might extend another 18 months. Today, a person diagnosed as HIV positive at age 21 has an average life expectancy of age 70. Just an astounding change. And that's been a collaborative effort between NIH researchers working with the private sector to develop the antiretroviral therapies which have made that possible. Cancer. Although we have a long way to go in terms of saying we have conquered cancer, and of course cancer is not one disease, it's hundreds of diseases, we are now seeing cancer rates falling about 1% each year, and that's been going on now for about 10 years. And many different trajectories there depending on the cancer type, but a lot of good news there. What about disabilities? In 1982, when you looked across this country and you asked for individuals over 65, what proportion suffer from a major life disability that interferes with the ability to conduct daily tasks? 27%. It's now well under 20%. And that's because of research that's led to things such as better treatment of congestive heart failure, which caused disabilities, replacements of joints that have been worn out, and other aspects of ways that we've reduced this very disturbing aspect of what it meant to be a senior citizen. So all of these achievements, I think one can say, have been a pretty good investment. Somebody did a calculation in terms of that reduction in heart attacks by what I said was 60% over the course of 40 years. How much did each American spend to make that possible? Well, each year, each American spent about $3.70 to achieve that kind of reduction, about the cost of a latte, a tall latte, not a grande, may I say. So pretty good investment, pretty good return on investment in terms of the health benefits. And these days, of course, it seems insufficient when you're talking about any way in which the government spends money to focus on just the benefits to health. We should also talk about economics because we are, after all, in a difficult situation in this country with a growing federal deficit and a high unemployment rate. But here, too, NIH has a pretty impressive story to tell. Those gains in life expectancy are estimated to be worth over $3 trillion every year. The 1% drop in cancer rates that happens is saving us $500 billion each year. The fact that NIH funds grants that go out to all 50 states creates something in the neighborhood of 500,000 jobs that are supported through those grants, and probably another 500,000 or more that are indirectly supported because NIH research triggers the founding of companies that hire lots of people in high-quality, well-paying jobs. And if you simply look to see what's happened as far as a return on the investment in the local economy, a couple of studies have recently demonstrated that it is a more than twofold return in economic goods and services in the local economy for every dollar that NIH puts forward in a grant. So we do believe that if there is a need to defend this particular investment, it is one that is quite solidly responded to, both in terms of human health and the economy. And I'm here to tell you that we've only really just gotten started. That there's never been a more exciting time scientifically than there is right now to be able to unlock the mysteries of diseases that have plagued us for all of human history and to come up with ways to prevent and treat those diseases that previously were out of reach and are now coming into our grasp. Let me just highlight a few areas where I think these advances are particularly promising right now. One of them is actually the marriage of medical research and technologies, because the ability to be able to ask really comprehensive questions about the human cell and what happens in various perturbing situations has come a huge distance because of the ability to apply high-throughput technologies to answer such questions. It won't surprise you, since you heard in the introduction that I had the privilege of leading the Human Genome Project, that I'm going to say something right now about DNA. That project, which stretched out over 13 years, ultimately yielded up the sequence of that first human genome, the DNA instruction book, for about $400 million just for the sequencing part, and then other costs to invent the technology to get there and a variety of other activities. We can now sequence your genome, or mine, for about $8,000. You've heard of Moore's Law for computers, where the ability to do computational work gets better by a factor of two every couple of years, and that's been sustained over many years. The speed in advances in DNA sequencing wildly outstrip Moore's Law in terms of the rate at which the cost is coming down and the throughput is going up. And that has put in our hands now the ability to do things in medicine that are really quite breathtaking. Let me tell you about Nick. Nick was born in Wisconsin about 5-6 years ago, seemed fine at birth, but over the course of the first few months of his life developed a really debilitating kind of intestinal condition, which in an adult would be called Crohn's disease, an inflammatory bowel disease, developing multiple fistulas, went through more than 100 surgeries, was wasting away from the effects of all of this, and there was no diagnosis. Nobody could figure out what was wrong. And his caregivers, reasoning that they had no other real options to get a diagnosis, decided to apply this cutting-edge DNA approach and looked at his DNA sequence across all of the genes in Nick's genome. And they found in one of the genes on his X chromosome a previously undescribed glitch that actually would cause that gene not to be functional. So they quickly went to read about it and discovered this was a gene that had been involved previously in a rare case in a couple of individuals of a blood disease, but never an intestinal disease. And they reasoned by looking at those cases and what they knew about the gene that what might actually give Nick a hope of survival was a stem cell transplant, a bone marrow stem cell transplant. And that's obviously a risky procedure, but they didn't have much choice. He underwent that transplant. Today, I think Nick is playing t-ball. He recovered all of his intestinal functions. He's now eating hamburgers. He has to be treated in terms of the transplant rejection risk, which is always the case after this. But clearly, they made the right bet. And this procedure has essentially cured him of what otherwise was going to be a fatal disease. That's just one example. I could cite you quite a few others where the ability to apply this kind of survey across the whole genome has provided answers that otherwise would have been elusive. And you should expect that the cost of sequencing your genome or mine will drop to below $1,000 in the next 3 or 4 years. And there will be a lot of interest at that point in having each of us have that information determined, placed in our medical record, available then for decision making if we are trying to practice better prevention or if we fall ill and that information might be useful in guiding therapy. And that's breathtaking to be able to say to you when that first genome only emerged 8 years ago, and now we're talking about doing everybody's for less than $1,000. I should say the area where perhaps that will have the largest implication in the next few years is cancer. Because cancer is a disease of the genome. Cancer comes about because of mistakes in the DNA that are acquired mostly during life, although there are also hereditary risk factors for cancer. In a project that NIH is sponsoring called the Cancer Genome Atlas, we are aiming to, in a very comprehensive way, identify what are all the ways that a good cell goes bad. And we're looking at the 20 most common cancers, starting with brain tumors, ovarian cancer, and lung cancer, and then moving on to the others. And in each instance, identifying tumor samples from at least 500 individuals
who also have given a blood sample so you can see the difference between the cancer cells and that individual's normal instruction book, and cataloging what we find, looking for repeating themes of reasons why that cancer has arisen that might then be actionable. Because the goal here is to identify new targets for therapy, and also to identify how some of the therapies that have been around for a while could be used more rationally. If you have cancer and you know exactly in your cells what are the drivers of that malignant situation, and you have a list of drugs over here whose targets are known, wouldn't you want to kind of put that information together and design your own chemotherapy aiming specifically at your cancer instead of a one-size-fits-all approach, which has traditionally been the best we had? So this is personalized medicine. In this case for cancer, ultimately we want to personalize a lot of what we do because we all have special molecular signatures of the illnesses that strike us, and you'd want to take advantage of that as soon as you have the evidence to do so. Genomics is providing the possibility of that kind of opportunity. So that's just one example of a technology that has come along. Again, I can't help but say there's also an economic story here. The total cost of the Human Genome Project, adding up what NIH and the Department of Energy spent on it, was $4 billion over 13 years. There was a recent assessment of what the economic growth has occurred from that project, adding up all of the economic benefits that have arisen from that, came to $796 billion. It's a return of 141 to 1, and that was just in the first 10 years. So that's not so bad. If you're worried about whether taxpayer money is going to good use, tell them that story. Another area, of course, enormous interest scientifically is the whole area of stem cells and the ability to be able to understand the signals that convince a cell of one type to evolve into another type, and particularly to take cells that are pluripotent, which means they have the potential to become almost any cell of the body, and create that kind of therapeutic opportunity. The most dramatic development in this scene over the course of the last 5 years has been the recognition that we could take a skin cell from any one of you and add just the right cocktail of four very specific genes and convince that skin cell to go back in time and essentially become pluripotent, where you could then convince it to become any other cell that you might need. Now, I hope you can see immediately the potential there, that if you have diabetes and you need to have your pancreas cells replaced that have lost their ability to make insulin, well, you know, take that skin cell, make it pluripotent, and then give it the right set of signals to become that pancreatic islet cell that you need. And it's your cell, so you're not going to reject it if it's given back to you. If you have sickle cell anemia, same idea. Take your cells, correct the sickle mutation, make them into a lot of blood cells, give them back. That's already been done in the mouse. There's no reason, theoretically, although there's a lot of work to do, that this couldn't be done in the human. Enormous potential. So some technologies. I just mentioned two. Genomics and stem cells. I could give you a longer list. But let me move on. How are we going to take all of these amazing basic science insights and make sure that they get to the clinic as rapidly as they should? And this is what we call translation. Translation has lots of other meanings. In medical science, it's the idea of taking that basic science discovery, and there's a profusion of those right now, and moving it as quickly as possible through all the steps necessary to bring it to the clinic in a form that you know is both safe and effective. And you heard in the introduction some of the statistics about just how hard it is to get that to work. I'm going to talk specifically about the development of therapeutics, drugs, if you will. And the standard analysis of this is 13 to 15 years from when you start down that path of trying to make a drug for a particular disease where you think you have a new idea about how to attack it and getting an approved drug out there for clinical practice. And the failure rate, 98%. An engineer would look at this and go, are you kidding me? That's your pipeline? 98% failure and it takes 13 years to find out you failed? I mean, come on here. There must be a better way. And I think there is. And I think the science that's come along in the last 4 or 5 years justifies the ability to say there could be a better way. until recently, we've kind of had to follow the steps that were being followed, and drug companies put all of their efforts into that, knowing how high the failure was, and occasionally succeeded. And that's why we have the drugs that we have, and it's wonderful. So many of them are, in fact, successful for so many people. But we also know we have great holes in our therapeutic ability to treat and effectively treat lots of diseases, both common diseases and rare diseases, and neglected diseases of the developing world. What could we do about this? Well, again, because the science has come along in dramatic ways in the last few years, I think the time is right for NIH, in partnership with biotech companies, pharmaceutical companies, advocates, the FDA, all sorts of other partners, to step in a new way. And that's what this new Center for Advancing Translational Sciences is all about. And it is not to turn NIH into a drug development company. Now, we have those, and they do a great job. The idea is to have NIH take the pipeline itself as the scientific problem. Say, where are the bottlenecks? Not just for one-off projects, but for all of the projects that people are pursuing. And how could we do something to achieve the goal of getting through those bottlenecks more efficiently without so much loss? How could you figure out whether you started with the right target? How could you figure out when you have a compound that looks sort of promising, will it be safe in humans? How can you design a clinical trial so you can get an answer quickly and inexpensively instead of spending years and thousands of patients' time to try to get that answer? So that's what NCATS aims to do, is to focus on the science of the pipeline. Let me give you one example that I just touched on in a little more detail, and that is drug safety. How do we decide when you're doing research and you have a good idea about a new drug for cancer, how do you decide whether it's safe to give to that first human in a trial? Well, there's a standard approach which has been used for years, decades, where you test that compound in a variety of systems. Some of them are in test tubes and some of them are in animals. Small animals, large animals. You look to see, is there any signal that indicates that there might be toxicity to the liver or the heart, and so on. And if you see such a signal, well, that's the end of that project. And we know that system doesn't work that well. We know there are compounds that are lost in that pipeline that probably would have been safe in humans, but once you've seen that animal signal, you're done. And we also know, because we see it all the time, that compounds that appear to be safe in animals, when you give that to a human, that first person ends up with a toxic side effect that could be quite serious. We'd like to do better. So how? Well, you want to know about human toxicity. So is there a way to test human cells without having to test humans? Well, you bet. Remember what I just said about stem cells and the ability to take skin cells and convince them to be liver cells or heart cells or muscle cells? We know how to do that now. So why don't we bring together the engineering capabilities of Silicon Valley and build a chip? And on that chip is not electrons and silicon, but actually cells. Cells from liver, from heart, from muscle, from kidney, designed in a way that you can then flow a molecule across it, a candidate drug, and ask the question with a variety of sophisticated readouts, do we make the cells unhappy? And if so, are they unhappy in a way that predicts toxicity? This sounds like science fiction. It's not really. People have already done versions of this of a simpler sort, and we just announced 10 days ago a collaboration between NIH and the FDA and DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, part of the Department of Defense, to work together on designing this chip to test for drug toxicity. And this is pretty exciting. DARPA, those are the people that brought you the internet, that brought you GPS. These are the wild and crazy innovators. And now they've gotten pretty interested in biomedical stuff too. And working together with DARPA, we're excited about what we might be able to do in a bold project over the next 5 years that would revolutionize the ability to do this bottleneck, one of several, in drug development, so that you could test things and know that the answers were more reliable and you could do it more quickly and more cheaply than the methods we currently use. That's just one example of the kind of thing that we'd like to do with NCATS. Let me give you one other. This long pipeline, this 13-year process, could be short-circuited if you were lucky enough to identify a drug that's already been tested in humans and known to be safe and you could find a new use for it, for a disease that is desperately in need of such a therapy. We'd call that repurposing or if the drug actually had never even been FDA approved because it was abandoned for lack of efficacy for its original application, it's sitting in a freezer somewhere, and it needs to be rescued for that new application. So rescuing and repurposing is another NCATS opportunity. And if you think that sounds unlikely, let me give you at least two examples. The first drug that showed efficacy against HIV, that gave us all the hope that this disease could be treated, was a drug called AZT. AZT was not developed for HIV/AIDS. It was developed for cancer. It didn't work for cancer. But it got repurposed and started a whole revolution in antiretroviral therapy. Another dramatic example, thalidomide. Remember that? Developed for morning sickness with tragic results because of the birth defects that occurred in the offspring of women who took that early in pregnancy. Did you know that thalidomide has a new life now as an approved drug for leprosy, and maybe more significantly for people in this country, as a very effective drug against multiple myeloma, a bone cancer? Who knew? But because the science has come along to allow us to begin to understand the molecular basis of disease and the molecular targets that drugs go after, you can start to put these things together. And if this worked sort of serendipitously for thalidomide, wouldn't you like to do it more systematically? And there are probably thousands of compounds in freezers right now in pharmaceutical companies that could get a new life, and this would be a win for the company because they invested a lot of money in those compounds and they're not getting anything back right now. It would be a win for the investigator who's looking for a treatment for a disease and doesn't want it to take 13 years, and it'd be most importantly a win for the public. Another thing that NCATS could do, encouraging this rescuing and repurposing, and we have a lot of interest now in the private sector in doing this and talking at some depth about how we might initiate such an effort in a more systematic way. So those are examples of what NCATS could do, examples of how translation is at a very exciting space. And it's not all about drug development. Let me just say one other example about vaccines. Influenza. We just went through this H1N1 thing, and if you thought that was the last time we'd be hearing about influenza pandemics, well, read your history books. It won't be. These things come along with great and frustrating regularity. And, of course, it's not just H1N1 that looms out there as a risk to us. The avian flu, about which there was a lot of concern 2 or 3 years ago, H5N1, it's still out there. We don't know when that might jump across from birds to people in a new and virulent form. As you know, for the last several decades, our approach to flu is to try to stay one step ahead, but sometimes it's one step ahead of us, because we're always looking to see what's just emerged, what are its characteristics, how can we quickly build a new vaccine that will work against the new strain. And as with H1N1, there's a lot of challenges in trying to do so if you want to immunize a very large number of people. Very recently, it has become clear that there's a real pathway towards the developing of a vaccine that would work against all influenza viruses, what you'd call a universal flu vaccine. So how does that work? Well, the problem is the body normally looks at the part of the virus that is most exposed, and that's the part that's most variable. But as we now have the structure of the proteins that sit on the surface of the influenza virus, and we have sequences of many different viral strains, we can see that there are actually parts of the influenza viral coat that are invariant. They're the same in H whatever, N whatever. They have the same structure. If you could raise an antibody against those invariant parts, it would work against everything. And we are learning how to do that. And the folks at the Vaccine Research Center at NIH are on top of this. And there are, I think, realistic predictions that we could be no more than 5 years away from having such a vaccine. If that were the case, the whole landscape of influenza pandemics would change dramatically and for the better. So that's just another example of the kinds of things that are now becoming possible. I could also talk about advances in preventing premature births, about advances in preventing diabetes, very exciting things going on there to do something about this disease, which is becoming such an epidemic. I could talk about our efforts in global health, because that's one of my personal priorities as well, is to invest some of NIH's resources in actually coming up with new approaches to those diseases that afflict the developing world in particularly strong numbers. remembering that global and domestic are not opposites. They are actually all part of the same world situation. And if you care about this country, you also have to now care about the rest of the world. But our most important resource is not even the ideas that I'm talking about. Our most important resource is the people, the scientific community on whom we depend to take this exceptional time in history and make it into a reality, to develop these breakthroughs that are waiting for a bright young mind to jump on and push us over with some remarkable innovation to a finish line. And here is where there's both great news and cause for concern. We do have remarkable talent that's migrated into the field of biomedical research. But they are also under stress. And they're under stress because of the fact that the resources to support them are not what perhaps ideally they should be. NIH, over the course of the last 50 years, has done most of its work by reviewing grants that are sent in by these best and brightest minds. They come forward sometimes in response to a signal that NIH sends saying we'd like to see more work done in this area. But many of the grants we get are unsolicited. They're reviewed by peer reviewers who are expert in the field, and decisions are made about who to fund on that basis. And for most of the last 50 years, the chance of getting your grant funded, if you came to NIH, was about 1 in 3. It is now less than 1 in 5. And that has come about because both of remarkable great ideas being put forward by great people, but it's also because the resources to support biomedical research have been, in terms of real buying power, shrinking since 2003. And we're about 20% lower now in terms of our ability to support science than we were 8 years ago. And that largely is because of inflation in the context of relatively flat budgets. This is the thing that wakes me up at night, is how do we, in this amazingly exciting time scientifically, make sure that the resources we have are being invested most wisely? And how do we respond to those scientists who aren't able to get supported and who are wondering whether they should stick it out or go on and do something else? And how do we, at a time where America's global competitiveness is certainly being challenged, justify the fact that other countries are moving much more quickly in terms of their expansion in research support, particularly China and India, than we are? And is that actually a good thing for our future? This is the reality of the situation. Now, I believe that the science is sufficiently exciting, and the investigators are sufficiently motivated that our field is going to stick it out here and accomplish great things. But I do worry about what we may lose along the way. And if you're a scientist who's just had your fourth attempt at a grant turned down, and your lab is about to close, you may decide that you're going to go do something else, and you won't come back the next year if things get a little brighter. We are at risk here, I think, of having a loss of a substantial sort of our most important resource. So that is the reality that we face, this paradox between great science and concerns about the challenges of the resource availability. And this caused me to go back and think of some other words that had been spoken to the Commonwealth Club here in San Francisco. And I found this from none other than FDR. September 23rd, 1932, Franklin Delano Roosevelt at this club. "Sometimes," he said, "the hand of discouragement falls upon us. It seems that things are in a rut, fixed, settled, that the world has grown old and tired and very much out of joint. But then we look around us in America, and everything tells us that we are wrong. America is new. It is the process of change and development. It has the great potentialities of youth." Well, he was right in 1932, and I think that's true right now in 2011. We have great potentialities. We have great promise. It is a great privilege for me to have a chance to stand at the helm of this remarkable organization, the National Institutes of Health. Our goals are noble. They're achievable. And it's my great privilege to have a chance to tell you about them this evening. Thank you all very much.
Well, that was just terrific. Thank you very much, Dr. Collins. It's a pleasure to have you here with us. I'm Larry Brilliant. I'm the president of the Skoll Global Threats Fund, and I'm your moderator tonight for the question part of today's program. We have a number of questions. In fact, this being San Francisco, with so many inquiring minds, I've calculated we have exactly 3 questions per attendee. So if you're ready, I've tried to group them. Many of them touch on issues you've already begun. If I can, I'll start with the first one. We have a lot of questions about the collaboration between NIH and FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. And the question is there a way for closer collaboration between the NIH and the FDA? Perhaps some joint appointments, joint ventures?
Great question. And I think I touched upon a few of the places where if advances in translation are going to succeed, they will need to be done in close partnership with the FDA. Peggy Hamburg, the FDA commissioner, and I started meeting even before I'd been officially confirmed by the Senate in order to try to make a plan about how our agencies could work together in unprecedented ways. We have formed a joint leadership council, which she and I co-chair personally, and out of that have come a series of working groups focused on specific issues that need attention. Peggy is a great champion of regulatory science, the idea that we need the scientific basis to make wise decisions about how we do regulation. And out of that has come a research program that we jointly support, as well as a number of initiatives, such as the one I mentioned that also involves DARPA, to try to look in a bold new way at testing for drug toxicity. The FDA has an awfully tough mandate. About 25% of our economy is regulated by the FDA. And when you go through all the things that they're responsible for overseeing, they're constantly being barraged by critics on one side saying that they're too strict and too rigid, and others saying they're too lax and they're letting things through that might cause human harm. And you can't win those battles because somebody will always say you tipped the wrong direction. I'm looking forward to the day when the Congress holds a hearing to congratulate FDA on what a great job they've been doing. I don't think they've had one of those. But I think their resources are severely limited. That's the other issue. FDA gets asked to do a lot with a little. We are determined to do what we can as a sister agency to try to speed up the process of incorporating some of this new science. But I certainly agree we won't succeed in the translational agenda unless we have really full engagement with the FDA. And I know they are excited about that, and we are too.
The country is so polarized, and one of the axes of polarization seems to be between the faith community and the scientific community. All too often, people of faith feel unwelcomed in the scientific community, and the scientific community finds the faith community unapproachable. How can we make science safe for people of faith, and how can we make it safe for scientists to talk with and be part of the faith community? You wrote a book along these lines, The Language of God. Would you be willing to talk with us about your feelings in that regard?
Yes, I would. I think it's a very important concern, and one which is sort of uniquely American, that we have at the present time such a sense of tension between the scientific and spiritual worldviews, as if you have to make a choice and you have to have one or the other. And that has been, I think, further pushed forward by some very vocal voices who I believe sort of rest at the extremes of this debate. On the one hand, some of my scientific colleagues who are outspoken atheists, who are using scientific arguments to try to say that spiritual perspectives are irrelevant and even dangerous. And on the other hand, those with very fundamental religious views who discount scientific findings about such things as the age of the earth, and therefore cast into doubt whether science can be trusted or whether science has a atheistic agenda and therefore ought to be disregarded. Most people don't live in those extreme views. Most people, I think, have a sense that these are different ways of answering different questions. That's where I come from. I'm a person of faith. I'm also a scientist. I think there are questions that can be asked with the tools of science about how nature works, and science is pretty darn good if you design the experiments right in getting those answers. But there's some other questions that are pretty important that science doesn't help you much, like what's the meaning of all this and is there a God?
if those questions are going to be answered, they're not going to be answered by the tools of science. You have to look elsewhere. I think those are questions that are worth pursuing, and that's where faith comes in as another way of knowing. But that is not a perspective that I think has been widely embraced in many parts of the American culture. And frankly, I think it has done quite a bit of a disservice to our potential as a nation, because if we have such a significant part of our population that feels as if science is attacking them, and they do, and if that same perspective then leads to a distrust of science, and if we need science to solve a lot of our problems, we're setting up a very difficult circumstance. We got into this situation in a very interesting way historically, and I think most people don't realize that the perspective, for instance, that 43% of Americans hold that the Earth has to be less than 10,000 years old in order to mesh with their view of Genesis 1 and 2, is not a perspective that was held by other people studying those same scriptures over the course of many centuries prior to 150 years ago. So if we could actually relive that experience with a little bit more perspective, we might find our way out of this thicket. That's certainly my goal in writing that book, The Language of God, was to try to put forward how one could be both a scientist who demands the data before accepting a conclusion about nature, but who also sees the spiritual approach and a belief in God as entirely rational, in fact, more rational than atheism, as I tried to argue it in the book, and finds it entirely wonderful to be able to live out the spiritual and the scientific worldview in an average Thursday without finding that his brain is exploding. And I think if that message resonates with more people, and I think it probably does, and if we could engage in a national conversation about why the extreme views really don't fit very well with the usual approach to philosophy, theology, and science, then perhaps we could gradually work ourselves out of this thicket. But it took us a long time to get here in this country, so I don't think we'll get there overnight.
Thank you very much for that answer. I think you may have begun a national conversation for tonight. You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Today we are speaking with Dr. Francis Collins, director of the National Institute of Health. Dr. Collins is discussing a revolution in biomedical innovation. Dr. Collins, another question from our audience. In your view, what is the responsibility of NIH in addressing global health issues beyond the U.S. borders?
I think NIH has a long tradition of supporting research in global health. It's my friend Julio Frank, who's now the dean of the School of Public Health at Harvard, who pointed out that global is not the opposite of domestic, and domestic is not the opposite of global. If you think that you can ignore what's happening in the rest of the world, go see the movie Contagion. It will remind you in a rather scientifically plausible way just how connected we all are in this world and how quickly disease can spread.
That was not an ad.
I get no kickback royalties from that film. But it is a reminder of the way in which disease doesn't know the boundaries that you see on your world map and travels quite freely, especially on airplanes across various locations. And it's also the case, if we were simply interested in being self-serving Americans, that there are important lessons to be learned by studying diseases in other parts of the world. Let me give an example. We are all Africans. Did you know that? We are all descended from an original founder pool of individuals that lived in Africa roughly 100,000 years ago. If you want to understand human biology, if you want to understand human genetics, if you want to understand humans, you got to study Africa. And so we've just started a project jointly with the Wellcome Trust, where we're studying both the genetic and environmental factors that lead to both communicable and non-communicable diseases in sub-Saharan Africa at a level of specificity not previously attempted. That's NIH dollars, excuse me, and it seems to me it's a very justifiable use. What we learn about that will teach us something about all of us.
If the point of NIH grants is to fund innovation, why are most grants given to researchers with most of the research, about two-thirds, already completed as preliminary results?
Well, I don't know if I'd agree with the two-thirds part, but there is an interesting problem here that we're clearly aware of. And this gets worse, of course, when resources are very tight. If you're sending your grant to NIH and you want this group of your peers to decide that you're in that top 20 or 15% that's going to get funded, you want to be really convincing about your proposal. And one way to do that is to propose things that you've essentially already gotten well along with. So the chance of failure is apparently quite a bit less, because you can say in your preliminary data that you already have evidence your approach is going to work. The problem, of course, is that may discourage real innovation, real out-of-the-box ideas. NIH is attempting to try to counter that trend by the establishment of a whole series of grant programs which simply do not allow you to apply unless you have a sort of wacky idea. And these have names like Pioneer Awards or New Innovator Awards, Transformative Grant Awards. So your grant in these situations gets screened to see whether what you're approaching, the idea you're putting forward, is truly likely to change the landscape in a significant way. And if you've already done it, well, sorry, you're ruled out. So this is a specific effort to counter that trend. It is, I think, always going to be the case that when money gets tighter, it is harder and harder for a peer review panel that's looking at both very solid grants from very experienced investigators in this pile and some kind of wacky, crazy ideas without a whole lot of preliminary data from investigators they don't know as well. Well, which one are they going to fund when they know they can only fund a few? The tendency is to be conservative. We're trying to fight that by having these particular areas of grant application that compete against each other for innovative science instead of against the more established approaches.
Would you like a glass of water?
I'm cool. I've got several up here, actually.
With public-private partnerships developing and emergence of peer-reviewed foundation grants, which are also supporting innovation, will NIH be necessary in 10 years?
Well, we welcome those partnerships, especially at a time of constrained resources. And we work closely with lots of those foundations to try to be sure that we're synergistic and not duplicative. Working with the Gates Foundation, for instance, in global health, or in a disease that I once spent a lot of time with, the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation, working on that disease in a collaborative effort with NIH. But frankly, there is no way, in terms of the needs of research to be conducted for those foundations, even putting all of their efforts together to compensate for what NIH is able to support. We are the largest supporter in the world. Those $30 billion are the main way in which biomedical research gets done in academic institutions. If that goes away, there's no way it could be compensated for by other sources of support. It would be a devastating outcome for American ability to do this kind of science.
Thank you very much for this talk. It makes me proud to be a scientist. What was your question?
Well, thank you for saying
along
so.
Along the same way, I do research funded by NIH, but not biomedical. Rather, how to increase health in communities by changing alcohol policies. We face frustrations in getting policymakers to adopt scientifically supported strategies. Any suggestions?
Well, it's a very good question because it points out this critical interface between science and science policy. I brought with me this evening Dr. Kathy Hudson, who's the Deputy Director for Science Outreach and Policy at NIH, who works at that difficult interface every day. First of all, if you're going to have good policies, you really want to have the evidence upon which to build them. The questioner refers to alcohol abuse as an area where we clearly need good policies about how to prevent the outcomes of that particular social and medical problem. And yet you'd want to have strong evidence if you're trying to implement a new policy that it's going to work. And actually, NIH does support a lot of that kind of research, testing whether new policies might, in fact, result in an improvement in public health. We have a whole institute, for instance, NIAAA, the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism, that conducts those kinds of studies. But we are, of course, not policymakers. What we hope to do is to be able to provide the information, the evidence that policymakers need in order to make wise decisions. That means we at NIH have lots of interactions with Capitol Hill, with lawmakers, with the administration, and we're always ready, when called, to come forward at a hearing or a briefing with all the research data that is needed to try to inform those decisions. But we are but one player in what is obviously a complex societal process of trying to make those right policies that the public is going to benefit from. We think we play that role pretty well, but we don't, I think, always get listened to as much as we would like.
How do you see translational medicine applying to fields such as environmental health, which focus less on the bedside and more on upstream causes and prevention of ill health?
Translation is a broad swath of activities. This evening I spoke particularly about drug development as one kind of translation. But translation also incorporates new ideas about prevention, about environmental health. So it is all part of this same package. NCATS, if it gets the appropriation we are hoping for from the Congress in this next fiscal year, will bring into its organizational structure the network of 60 clinical and translational science award institutes, one of which is here in San Francisco. These centers focus on all aspects of translation and training, and many of them are, in fact, quite interested in the idea of prevention research and community outreach, where you try to test whether new innovations in prevention or treatment work in the real world or not. So that is, in fact, very much part of what translational science is going to be in this new environment that NCATS will create.
This follows an earlier question that you raised. How do you expect to keep young, newly minted PhDs and MDs involved in groundbreaking research when most postdoctoral scholars are paid less than people with entry-level jobs and bachelor's degrees in their field, or even the NIH minimum stipend?
I have a feeling that question might have come from a postdoc. And I would totally understand it if it did. Yeah, postdoctoral fellows are such a critical part of the way in which American biomedical research gets conducted and succeeds. These are individuals who've already obtained a PhD degree or the MD or the MD-PhD, and they come and work in a laboratory for another principal investigator for periods of 3 to 5 to 7 years, during which time they are not fully independent. And they are, in fact, pretty much following direction of the principal investigator, although hopefully in a good lab they're increasingly able to develop their own research ideas and then ultimately go on to the next step in their career. NIH is quite concerned. I'm concerned about the way in which this particular structure may be keeping some creative individuals in a circumstance where they're not able to fully express that creativity. And the most striking statistic about this is that the average age at which an investigator gets their first independent grant from NIH is 42. If you look at the statistics about when individuals have made their most significant scientific contributions, many of them were before age 42. So you have to wonder whether this system is serving those individuals well and serving the public well. So we're working on ways to try to shorten that period of training, one of which is a program we just started, which is called the Skip the Postdoc Award, which... basically, for particularly creative and independent-minded and mature investigators, go straight from their PhD degree to an independent position. That's one. Another thing we're trying to do is something about the stipends. But, of course, in the current climate, it is difficult to do a lot about that. But even so, in the current last couple of years, we have increased those stipends, even though it meant funding fewer grants. I just think it's not appropriate to ask people to do what they do in terms of the wonderful work they do without compensating them a little better. We still are not where we should be. All of those things will help a bit. But one question that we really ought to have a better answer to is, what's the right size of our graduate and postdoc workforce? On any given week, I can tell you, somebody will come to me and say, you're not training enough doctoral level biomedical researchers. We have needs. They're not being met. And somebody else will come and say, you're training too many graduate and postdoc researchers because there aren't enough faculty positions to accommodate them all. Well, both those statements can't be right. Part of the problem is that we, I think, have been way too focused on tenure-track positions in top-tier universities as the only acceptable pathway for a scientist. And there are lots of other pathways that are truly exciting, and we probably have done a disservice to our trainees by discounting or calling those all as alternative careers. They're not alternative careers. They're careers. And we should do a better job of explaining that. I've set up a group and asked Shirley Tillman, who's the president of Princeton, to lead this group, to do a full and thorough analysis of the biomedical research workforce, to develop a model that will help us figure out what are all the various places that need these trainees, what are their needs, what's the input function to this in terms of individuals who want to be trained both from here and abroad. Are they going to stay in the U.S.? Are they going to go back, as increasingly they are, partly because our visa system is not very friendly and partly because opportunities are growing abroad? We need to understand this, and we don't at the present time have such a model. We will have one perhaps in another year, and then maybe we can make rational decisions. But I do think the point of the question is very well taken. We need to recognize that postdocs are just at a critical part of the success of the whole American biomedical research engine and should be honored as such.
We're coming to the last one or two questions. I kept a non-controversial one for now. How will the new Institute of Translational Medicine avoid simply subsidizing profit-making pharmaceutical companies by relieving them of the need to spend dollars on the translational steps between academic labs and pharma factory?
Well, again, NCATS does not aim to substitute for what drug companies do. We aim to try to develop better scientific approaches to make that process more successful with a lower failure rate and a shorter time course. Pharmaceutical companies are very supportive of those kinds of goals and willing to partner with us in new ways that involve shared resource commitments to make that happen. So this is certainly not a way to sort of have the government step in and take over what pharma and biotech are doing. It's to try to empower the whole system to be more successful. Because we're on a track right now that doesn't look very promising. The number of new drugs approved by the FDA over the course of the last few years, if anything, has been going down a little bit each year, despite what seems to be an increasing investment by pharma in developing those drugs. So we have a system, the pipeline, that is really not succeeding. If we can make a small contribution to identifying those engineering problems, then this will be empowering to pharma and probably would encourage them to invest more rather than less. They are under pressure right now from their investors to cut back their resources in R&D because of the failure rate being so high. If we could start to boost that up again, that might turn this around.
I think it's time to give our thanks to Dr. Francis Collins, Director of the National Institutes of Health. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio. This program has been generously underwritten by the California Healthcare Foundation. I'm Dr. Larry Brilliant, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of enlightened discussions, is adjourned. Thank you.